Welcome back, Nate. We are backstage in dressing room 3.
Yes.
At the HOW conference, continuing our guest recordings. And we have with us today, speaker Shel Perkins.
Shel, how are you doing today?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for asking. Welcome to the Reflex Blue Show.
Now, for those who don't know, Shel is an author. Now, you're not really a graphic designer right now. You're a consultant. Were you originally
Yeah, I have a degree in graphic design. And then when I started working, I found that a lot of the studios where I was working, really the need was more on the business side, the management side, project tracking, project management, planning, finances, all of that. So somehow my career started redirecting kind of into design management. So that's where I've been for the last 10, 15 years.
And during that time, you also served on the AIJ San Francisco board. You said 7 years on the board there?
I was on the San Francisco board for a long time, partly because it was such a great experience. But they first asked me to join the board when I was working with Clement Mock. And
Were you working at his studio or when he was at Apple? Or
After he left Apple, he opened a studio in San Francisco. And I met him after his studio had been open for maybe 2 or 3 years. Eventually, I served as his director of operations for about 5 years. And in the middle of that time, you know, the internet came along. This is like mid-90s. And AIGA San Francisco asked me if I would join the local board in order to do programming that was web-related. So that was the start.
And I assume that their chapter being in San Francisco is a little bit earlier than the other chapters really pushing the internet part?
A little more tech-heavy out there?
Well, the chapters have grown up over the last 30 years, really. But San Francisco was one of the earlier chapters, and a lot of our members tend to be involved in new technology. So it probably was one of the first chapters to do programming that was specifically related to that.
And you also then recently just served 3 years on the AIJ National Board, which you said you rolled off of.
Right. Last summer, I finished up my 3-year gig, and it's a lot of work. Most people on the National Board take on a particular initiative. There's a particular cause that they are putting a lot of energy into.
Right. Sean Adams put up the big gala, for example.
Yeah.
Right?
Big parties.
Doing the Black Tie Gala is a huge project. And also doing the GAIN conference. That takes some serious work. And during my time on the board, I served as the national treasurer. So I had financial responsibilities. I interfaced quite a bit with Rick and with Denise, who's the director of operations in New York. And once a year, I had to go to New York to meet with the outside auditors who were finalizing our financial statements and doing our federal filings. And also, once a year, I would meet with our investment advisors. So being treasurer is a certain workload in and of itself. But quite separate from that, I was helping to launch the Center for Practice Management.
Yeah, could you tell us, and our listeners, of course, a little bit more about that?
Well, we're about 3 or 4 years, maybe 4 years into it. And it's an idea that came out of one of the summer leadership retreats. You know, every summer there are chapter members from all around the country who get together and talk about, issues.
Yeah.
Talk about trends. You guys have been there. That's how we met.
Yeah, we even hosted one in Omaha.
Yeah. And they, actually, by the time this airs, we'll have just had one a week or so before, which was like yesterday. But this won't go up for a week, so.
Yeah, there's one that's just wrapping up in Chattanooga.
Mm-hmm.
But I mention it because I went to a whole series of those retreats, and there was one in St. Louis a few years ago. And there was a group of people kind of off on the side who started brainstorming about what do our members need where we haven't really been meeting those needs. Are there new resources? Are there new initiatives that really could create a lot of value for our members? And the idea that came up from this table, from this brainstorming group, was to create something called the Center for Practice Management to share kind of behind the scenes, behind the curtains, business information with designers. And you guys are familiar with AIGA membership. It's, mm-hmm. it's quite diverse, but usually about one-third of our national members are students. And a lot of our professional members are early on in their careers. Some of them are freelancers. Some of them are employees in creative companies. And a lot of them graduated from design degree programs that didn't include any sort of required course on professional practices.
Right.
So there are a lot of extremely talented people in our community who don't really have a good understanding of copyright, trademark, tax issues, you know, various
taxes,
sort of...
Taxes, what are those?
Yeah. See what I mean? So it's operational issues like that that the Center for Practice Management was created to address. And for the last few years, we've been creating resources that live on the AIGA site. When you go to AIGA.org, you can navigate to an area that's called the Center for Practice Management.
And coincidentally enough.
Yes. And we have about 6 different content areas. Financial management, human resources, project management, etc. And right. We have articles written by experts. We have podcast files that you can access. And last year, we also did a series of webinars. We did about 8 webinars on different topics like insurance and pricing.
Yeah, so that system goes really deep into it. I mean, I was not expecting human resources to be a part of that, for instance.
And is this geared towards firms or freelancers, or is it geared towards all designers? Or do you have to write separate documents for each because of the size of the clients that they would be pitching to?
Well, that's something that we talked about a lot coming into it. We had a task force that sort of came up with the original structure for it. And we realized that we needed to have a lot of assets that were kind of at the beginner level for our student and young freelancer members. So there is basic introductory information about each of those topics. But over time, we've also been adding some more advanced resources that are for people who manage teams right. or people who own or manage entire creative firms.
It sort of becomes a question of scaling that information to the size of your shop or
exactly.
operation.
It's the level of complexity. So you need to understand the basics, and then you build on that in various ways, especially when it comes to legal issues. So most students don't really know enough about copyright and trademark law. And by the time that you're managing a creative firm or maybe founding your own, you need to know how those issues are reflected in contracts and how you address them when you're going through client negotiations.
So you mentioned actually several times now, the sort of the educational system, in specifically design programs that don't have courses that relate to the business side of graphic design. I think my question for you is that something you feel is vital to a designer's education that a graphic design program should take on, or do you feel that that would be incumbent upon the student to pursue, for instance, a minor in business management?
I think that it needs to be a degree requirement. So when I was working on my design degree back in the 80s, there was no business information that was included at all. I had one production instructor who forced us to keep timesheets, and when we handed in a completed project, we had to let him know how much time we had put into it.
My God, you know what? I'm going to start doing that.
That's not a bad idea.
I teach. I'm going to find maybe just one project, maybe just the final. That's a great idea.
Yeah, it's a small thing, but that was it. So I graduated with a portfolio and, you know, I think a certain amount of ability and a lot of enthusiasm. And when I got out into the working world, I had to learn all this other stuff the hard way. What I would like to see now is for design degree programs to require professional practices. It should happen probably somewhere in the final year,
yeah.
Just like it does in architecture programs. So you can't become an architect in the United States. You can't receive an architecture degree without completing the professional practice requirements that happen usually in your final year of the degree program. And that shows you how to set up an office and make it sustainable.
Okay, I agree completely with that line of thought. And as an educator, yeah. Sorry, you've rendered me almost speechless with that. Yes, my program needs to have a professional practices, so does every other one. Yeah.
The reason I like this a lot is that if it's actually brought in with the business, you know, if the business class is actually with design, a lot of times they say, well, you should take a design class, or if you're a designer, you should take a business class or a couple business classes. But a lot of that information, I mean, even though it may be useful, doesn't talk to the creative as a creative.
It's not specific to...
Well, my perspective is that there are 2 separate sets of business issues. So sometimes people talk about design and business, and it's really fuzzy what they mean by that. There are client-facing issues, and that's the kind of stuff that AIGA has addressed for a number of years through the GAIN conference and through the summer management program that used to be at Harvard and now it's at Yale. And that has to do with successful collaborations It's centered on case studies of designers partnering successfully with clients to create value and to impact society. So those are kind of the external public issues, if you will. But what I'm talking about in terms of design business is the behind the scenes, day-to-day, nitty-gritty operational issues like calculating pricing, negotiating contracts, hiring and firing, those daily operational issues that traditionally people have learned the hard way by going out there and making mistakes. And I think that holds the profession back. I think there are best practices that can be shared. So it's really great that so many design degree programs have started to add a professional practices course. The snag is that in some of those schools, it's an elective. And you can probably guess that design students, just like any student, they don't know what they don't know. Right. They're not aware of what the gaps are in their own preparation, and they don't really understand what the importance or what the value might be of those things. So when they're in their last year and they're choosing between electives, it's a toss-up between professional practices and experimental typography 5. And they're going to go with experimental typography 5 because they're trying to wrap up their portfolio.
From my experience, or my, you know, in college, I didn't expect that I would be working for myself, and so I probably would have passed on that elective because I'm like, oh, obviously this won't pertain to me. I'm going to work for a company.
And I'll be a creative director in 2 years at giant advertising firm X. Yeah.
And they'll have you know, an HR department that'll handle that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes that works out really well because right out of school, you've got a lot of talent. You don't necessarily have a handle on these business issues. But if you get hired into an existing studio, somebody else's consultancy, basically you're going to be serving an apprenticeship. So for the next 2 years, 2.5 years, you're going to be learning the ropes. You'll be learning those behind-the-scenes issues by observing how your boss does it. And if you come out the other side of that employment situation and go on to become an entrepreneur, now you have a reference point. You've seen how your former boss managed projects. You've seen some of that documentation. Maybe you know how your former boss calculated prices. So even if it was done badly, at least you have a point of reference. A lot of students do not have that.
I have a friend of mine that he says that he got everything he learned by doing it the opposite of how his former employer did it.
Well, sometimes parents...
You tell me who that is off the air?
Yeah, he did have a reference point, though, and he said, I think that did help out.
Sometimes parenting works that way. You have your kids, and you think, I'm going to raise them in the opposite way that my parents raised me. And I think that works in the business community as well, but at least you have a starting point. And if a student is graduating from a program that didn't address professional practice issues at all...
Which is 90%.
Then you got nothing.
Common, yeah.
Yeah.
Let me ask... outside of that, I mean, you were here. You just spoke at the How Creative Freelancer conference. Okay, we talked about. I have it on a different page.
The art and science, the art of pricing, science and pricing project.
At that conference, there are a lot of young designers who are starting out. There's also a lot of people with a lot of years under their belt, and specifically even with freelancing, that are still running into, you know, later into their careers, a lot of these issues of running their own business and making it a sustainable business. Do you feel like that's almost an innate hardship that designers kind of bring upon themselves? Like, what is it? Sorry, I'm having trouble getting this one out. What is it about graphic designers that maybe leads us to feel like we just don't have a business sense? I feel like it's common enough that's almost a shared trait.
Well, sometimes there's a sort of machismo about it, that I'm doing such great design and I'm losing my shirt. I'm on the verge of going out of business, and that just proves how great a designer I am.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's this sense that the other stuff is not important, that talent is the only requisite. If I have that creative skill set, then everything else is just not important.
Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Well, that's the challenge. If you are the founder of a company, you have to realize pretty quickly that the company needs more than one skill set. And you can't just clone yourself as you begin to hire people to help you complete projects. So you need to hire people who know stuff that you don't know. You need people who have other skill sets that the company needs. And one of the things that I do sometimes in consulting relationships is we diagram what is the full range of skills necessary for this creative company to be healthy, and then which segments of that are already taken care of. And almost inevitably, we see these big gaps. And that is the next action for us, to figure out how are we going to plug these gaps, because those missing skill sets are what's holding us back. That's why we're not profitable. That's why we're having so much trouble with these various issues, because we didn't hire for that. So as you move forward, you can either do cross-training in a very conscious way, or you can create new positions and do new hires in order to fill those gaps that the company needs to be healthy.
So what happens when a designer has started out their own firm and grown it to a certain size where maybe they can't take on the design work anymore? We have a friend, Drew Davies. He keeps his shop at three people, because if he has a fourth person, then there's going to be more behind-the-scenes work that needs to be done than design work, and he won't be able to design anymore.
Well, that's the classic situation. That's kind of old school. I think graphic design worked that way in the 50s and the 60s, that each studio was just an extension of one individual. Mm-hmm. So there was some talented designer whose name was on the door. That person had two or three assistants who were maybe student interns. And all of the work was done for clients that the founder knew. So the business reflected the personal relationships of the founder. And that makes it almost impossible to transition the company to a second generation of ownership.
Right.
Because it's too small, it's too dependent upon one person. And the old model was for that founder to extract value on an annual basis. So if you had a really good project, you would take the profits. If you had a really good year, you would give yourself a better salary, better benefits. It was there just to support you. And by the time you get to the end of your working career, the business has been kind of tapped out. There's nothing left in the business of value. So you're just going to stop taking new assignments, lock the door, and then maybe you'll have a garage sale. Because you've got some used furniture, old equipment. There's nothing there. So that's really old school. The current approach is to say, design is a problem-solving process. And we're working with clients who have a range of needs. That makes our work multidisciplinary. The work is done by teams. So design is a team sport today. It was done successfully by individuals, I think, in the 50s and 60s. But now, most of us are on multidisciplinary teams.
Right.
Right. And within that team, you might have the potential next generation of ownership. So the founder needs to start thinking consciously about exit strategies. At some point in the future, you're going to be too tired, too sick, too bored, whatever, to do this anymore. You don't want to just lock the door. It's a going concern. It's a viable business. It has relationships. It has resources. It can thrive without you if you figure out how to transition the ownership.
Now, the other thing is when you're writing these pricing, and we can go, you can go to the AIJ website and pick up contract language. It's all there. Do you have to log in to be a member, or is it just for everybody?
Well, initially, all of the Center for Practice Management content was available for free. And one of the first things that we worked on was an update of that sample contract. So there's a PDF file of the standard form of agreement for design services that's available for anybody to download for free. And that's because we want it to be adopted as an industry standard. It's what attorneys would call usage of trade. AIGA is in the process of trying to affect usage of trade. But beyond that, we have all of this other stuff, and there have been conversations about this. Some of the really high-value content might be restricted to members.
Okay.
So at some point, it's going to become a mix of free versus members only.
And the reason I mention this is because you also say that you wrote this at the same time that you wrote your book, Talent Is Not Enough, Business Secrets for Designers, which you said it has just been revised and expanded by 60 pages of content?
Right. Rick Raffay was very kind. He came to me and said, well, I know that you're working on these various book chapters, could AIGA publish some of them as articles? So we worked out an arrangement whereby a lot of my earlier versions were distributed to AIGA membership. And there were some slight tweaks made for the first edition of the book. But since then, 4 years have passed, and a lot's been happening in our profession.
Right.
Including, of course, the current recession that we're trying to pull out of. So I think business savvy, operational expertise is more important now really than ever. And so I've added some additional chapters, some brand new stuff that wasn't there before.
So tell us a little bit more about Talent Is Not Enough as a book. What was your overall goal in writing that book?
Well, I wanted to create a resource that would actually meet two different needs. And one is the need of students and young designers to get a better handle on the basics. But as a design manager myself, being, you know, umpteen years into my career, and in the consulting work that I do, I work with established firms that are mid-sized or larger, and there are these more complex issues.
What do you consider a mid-sized firm?
Well, in the design community, mid-sized is maybe 10 or 12 employees.
Yeah.
Large gets to be maybe 40.
Sometimes those of us on the no coast like to make sure that we're in line with those kinds of things. Like mid-sized to us, I was thinking about, 10 to 15, but you don't know. You go out to like New York or LA, maybe mid-size is like 30 or 40. We don't know.
Well, the U.S. government, the U.S. government keeps a lot of statistics, and they say that I think just over half of our overall economic activity is produced by small businesses. But they define a small business as being a company with 100 or fewer employees. And if you're looking at design-related companies, there are very few that are that large.
Right.
So you'll get a Future Brand or a Landor. They're quite big, partly because they are owned by advertising holding companies. So that's really kind of on a completely different scale. If you're looking at independent consultancies, large ones are about 40 employees, I would say.
Right. Okay.
So that was kind of my secondary audience. I had those two. And that meant that I had to have content at two different levels, kind of like what we were just discussing with the Center for Practice Management.
I was just going to ask you about overlap.
It was that same challenge. Okay, so my solution was to arrange the information to follow the arc of a career. It starts off with basic advice for students in terms of getting into the right degree program and understanding a little bit about what the career options are within the profession. And then it talks about job hunting. So I have a couple of chapters that are about getting out there and identifying companies that you're interested in, giving a good interview, going through the hiring negotiation, and then successfully getting through that 3-month orientation period, mm-hmm. coming up to speed and becoming a valued team member. So we talk about being an employee, and then we come out the other side of that and talk about freelancing. So I talk about how the IRS defines an independent contractor. There are 20 common law factors that are often used in audits to determine if you really were an independent contractor or whether you should have been an employee and you were just misclassified. So we talk about that, and I have a sample independent contractor agreement. Then a lot of people are successful as freelancers, and they have the opportunity to grow their own small studio. And that leads us into those classic small business issues. Where are you located? What do you call the company? Do you need a local business license? What do you need to have in place in terms of insurance? Mm-hmm. What are the basics of bookkeeping? The invoicing cycle that you'll be going through with your clients. And then we talk about marketing. So there's information about identifying opportunities, getting yourself considered as a viable service provider, and that leads us into pricing. So there are several chapters about pricing-related issues, and those come together into fixed-fee proposals. So I have a certain format that I work with, and I recommend a certain structure for fixed fee proposals.
The kind of the three-pronged structure, was that the one that you covered?
Which we discussed today in the session, yeah. And then you would attach legal terms and conditions, and that opens this whole big box of legal stuff.
One of the things that I caught, and you actually addressed this in your talk this morning, before your session, we had the financial session, which is always incredibly sobering but useful, and then we had the legal copyright and contractual protection session that was just before yours. And one of the things that you kind of brought up was that a lot of the things that I can't remember her name now.
Jean Perwin.
Yes,
attorney.
Jean. that she would recommend that you do as a lawyer in your contracts that you wouldn't necessarily recommend that everyone do those all of the time.
Yeah, I'm a designer, so... When we updated the AIGA sample contract, we actually had a team. There were two designers, myself and Jim Ferris, who was on the national board at that time. And then we had outside attorneys who helped us to address various issues. But if you go to the AIGA site and download that free PDF, you'll see that it's kind of long, and it addresses a lot of different issues, but I think it's all really good stuff. So that's kind of the center of the book. By the time we get to the center of the book, we've talked about legal issues, I've explained the background, and then boom, it leads into the AIGA sample contract, mm-hmm. which I've included there. Then I have it's kind of a brief chapter about ethical issues, social responsibilities.
I watched Mad Men. There's no ethical issues in our industry.
Cause-related marketing. And, you know, there's so much going on in the design profession right now in that area. And there are conferences, and there are books, and there's all kinds of stuff. And so I included it in a small way. Just to point out how important it is. But that's not really the essential content of my 460 pages.
Right, yeah. There's a lot more to it than simply the giving back factor.
Yeah, and I couldn't really do justice to all of that. But then it moves on into mid-sized firms. So assuming that you've made it that far, you probably have issues related to making your systems scalable.
Growing up to an appropriate
size for the kind of challenges that you want to take on. So there's a chapter on team issues. There's a chapter on managing large projects. If you have a big project that lasts, say, a year or more, you're going to have to take a more detailed approach to it because there's more at risk. There are more moving parts. There's more that can go wrong. And eventually it leads to a chapter about exit strategies. So if you have built up this successful firm, eventually you probably want a way to cash out. So you're looking for a way to transition ownership to the next generation.
So, Donovan, do you have any questions about transitioning between phases? Or is that too... We don't have to go there, but I'm just curious because I know because you're up to...
I think the book...
You're up to an intern...
Just talent is not enough. Business Secrets for Designers may answer this for me.
You're up to an intern and a part-timer right now. I feel like you're just on the cusp. Ready to go.
We shall see.
We can talk about that right now, is all I'm saying.
What we do need to talk about, though, is Amy, Bridget, and Jesse from How Design.
They were on our previous program.
Yes.
And so we're doing this, and we're having our guests ask the next guest a question. So their question for you was, what one business tip would you give to the How brand?
Oh, geez. I don't know. How is a machine?
True that. They do a lot. That's one of the main things we talked about. It's just like, you do books and magazines and conferences and competitions. And I think there were even more things that they lived than web content.
They have competitors in all of those areas. So traditional publishing, online publishing, and then events. The last 3 or 4 years have been really quite tough for conferences in general. There are fewer design-related conferences today than there were 3 years ago. So I think How is actually one of the survivors. I think they've been doing some of the right stuff.
I get that,
so
too.
I don't really have a question for them. I would just say keep on doing what you're doing.
Or a tip?
The tip is keep on doing what you're doing.
Identify what you have been doing. Continue.
Do not stop.
Rinse and repeat.
Straight from the mastermind himself.
And then for you, our next guest next week, we have Russell Brown from Adobe. If you have any questions for Russell Brown.
Oh, well, what I would really like to know is what's up with Flash.
Okay, let's just do it.
But I don't think
you're going to open with that.
I don't think I could ask him that. But maybe you could ask him.
You know what? We can have that conversation on microphone right now. Trying to figure out a way to broach that topic because I know that we're going to have to, and yet I'm nervous. Yeah. I don't want to just roll in here and be like, so, Russell, tell me about Flash.
Yeah, most of us don't get very many emails from Steve Jobs, but there was that email that went out about Flash, so yeah. What's up with that?
Yeah, you know, the other one that I'm dying to know about is the Adobe Acrobat rendering of the lowercase letter form L or I, where it makes that letter form because it's rectangular, appear a little bit larger than the rest of the type around it.
Don't ask him that. He might go ballistic.
Yeah, okay, because they've never fixed it. Anyway. Well, so, Donovan, are we wrapping it up here?
We are wrapping it up. Although I do got to ask you, I mean, last time we saw you, we were in Memphis. We had barbecue. We had a guy.
We had barbecue sauce all over us, yeah.
And in between, there were ducks in your hotel. You got ducks in the hotel here in Denver, or did they?
No, unfortunately.
They keep the fowl out.
You were in the duck hotel, because we walked through there.
Yeah, I missed those ducks.
But so no ducks, no buffalo or bison, I guess it would be in Colorado? Anything? Any kind
of live animal? Not that I've noticed, but of course I've been inside.
There is that giant blue bear trying to get in the conference center here.
That bear is going to make it someday, Donovan Berry. He's going to get in. What I want to do more than anything, and now we're just rambling at the end of the show, but I just want to build a big giant honey pot on the other side of that.
Because Nate said, why is he looking in the window? I said, probably trying to get honey.
Yeah.
Well, it's just like an actor. What's my motivation?
Right. So, Shel Perkins, thank you so much for taking time out of your day.
All right, thank you, guys.
Congratulations on your AIGA Fellow Award.
Thank you very much.
All right, and if you want to know more, head on out to your local bookstore, head online, and go ahead and pick up Talent Is Not Enough. And if you guys want to hear more from the Reflex Blue Show, go to 36point.com for this and all kinds of other crazy content coming to you from the 2010 HOW Conference in Denver. Donovan, let's take it out.